Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WIEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Michael Worster, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Kevin Prufer. Hi, Kevin.
Hey.
Well, I want to introduce Kevin, and he's having quite a career as a poet. He teaches at Central Missouri State University, has been there for 14 years. He has three published books, the most recent of which is Fallen from a Chariot from Carnegie Mellon University Press. He's the editor of Pleiades, which is a very, very fine literary journal, and also Pleiades Press, which is publishing poetry books. So there's quite a bit going on, and we're very privileged to have him here this evening. You're going to find his work quite exciting. And just to prove that, right away, I'll invite Kevin to read a few poems.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot, Michael. I think I'll read some poems from Fallen from a Chariot.
Good.
Poems about ancient Rome, sort of ostensibly about ancient Rome. There's a story about Nero, you know, the probably apocryphal story that Fiddling while Rome burns,
yeah.
Right. And that at the end of his life, the proper thing for him to have done, having lost his grip on power, would have been to kill himself, but unable to muster the courage to do that, he had to get his bodyguards to kill himself for him. His final words were supposedly, "What an artist the world is losing." This is called Beautiful Nero. We'd made such a day of it, until the sun fell behind the trees and the street lamps came awake, and we drank and sang, and old Paula fell out of her chair into the street, while Wilson spilled my drink then called the waitress with the sponge. And then the boys were dragging cafe tables inside for the night, the metal legs scraping the pavement white. "Good night, Irene, good night," I called into the air, and "Drink up," Paula said. "Drink up," laughing and opening her purse, and then I was alone and had to find another place to sit. In the back of my throat, some god once burned a song. "How beautiful," my mother said, when as a boy I opened my mouth to sing. "Lovely, lovely, a blister and a scar. Like Nero, I can't help but add a trill to any bit of paper caught and fluttering down the street, or the cat slipping past on a blur of legs. And oh," she said, when at the piano the silver thread of my voice unrolled. The night Rome burned, Nero sang. Yes, the lyre told him, and he played, perched on the balcony. "Sing," the city said in its embers, and Nero sang, and the buckets of water passed hand to hand below, called more, and the girls in the streets, their gowns burning so gently up their bodies, clapped bravo, while all at once the library heaved and crumbled, fell in upon itself, and died. "And beauty," Nero said under his breath. His hands stopped on the lyre, his face orange in the smoke-filled light. Years later, the bombers came like little black notes over the city, like trills. Yes, I lost the song in my throat, but crouched in the park beneath the trees, hands over my head, and cried, thinking of no one but myself, while the deep-voiced bombs called one building after another into the ground. And all at once, a treetop bloomed in flame. And I sat in the park and sang as Paula and Wilson staggered home, while across the road the cafe owners turned out their lights. "Lovely, lovely," I remember my mother saying. "It's beautiful," clapping her hands from the living room when I was through. "Beautiful," I thought, leaning back on the park bench while the city dozed and the lights went out on such music. The ache in my throat, a quiet evening. And in the end, Nero couldn't do the job, but cried for his slave to finish him off. And from the ashes of Rome, the troops approached so he could hear their horns and boots, always a scar where a god burned a song. How lovely when a city dies and one is far enough away to make a song of it. I sat in the park and sang. The city crouched in a darkness, and then the slave said yes, drawing his blade.
See, what I love about your work, one of the things is that in a poem ostensibly about Nero, we've got Paula and Wilson and your mother, and there are episodes from the story of Nero that don't sound like ancient Rome, but sound like contemporary Europe or 20th century Europe or 21st century somewhere. That's so interesting.
I had this theory about those poems. I was thinking that for this most of this book, I was sort of imagining that if one could be in a place in several times at once and take pictures of them and maybe put those pictures on clear overhead projector uh-huh. paper and layer them on top of each other, that was something like what I was trying to do. So
I wonder if you'd read a poem that I like a lot from The Fingerbone, your second book, called Divorce.
Divorce. All of the names have been changed. Someone had entered the yard that night in order to protect the innocent. My mother, we'll call her Cynthia, was in the kitchen watering the plants that decorated the country house windows. When suddenly she heard a sawing from the woods. This is a true story. When suddenly she heard a sawing from the woods. This is a true story. Out back behind the house, when a strange man cut the largest tree with a crash into the moss, and such a cloud of dust and birds rose to the treetops and beyond. Mine was the wisp of hair that came lovingly to her cheek. Mine was the breath against the silk of the blouse. But whose was the saw that leveled the tree and the second tree? One by one, the trees fell, and this, a true story, though the names have been changed, the two of us afraid in a way in the dark even to open the front door and call into the black woods, though I, only a child, will call me by my own name. And she, Cynthia, tangled in all this, watering can in hand, paused over the spider plant and the dishes not even done, the Jeep parked on the gravel drive, not a telephone between here and town, and my father will call him that. Who knew what he was thinking at that very moment? What could we do? So to protect the innocent, we turned off the house lights one by one, locked the doors as, at that very moment, a laughing from the woods just outside the house. Difficult to describe, though, it sounded not unlike the sound of the saw, if I must make it clear. Up, up into the attic we crawled, and out with those lights, too, until, in retrospect, in the darkness, there were so many things that horrible year. The bursting of dams, my brother gone, the letters always laughing in the mailbox, and forever, somewhere, someone anonymous, hungry. Mine was the crying into Cynthia's skirt. Mine was finally the lost in sleep in the air beneath the attic window with the nameless man in the yard that by sunup was scattered with the black half fingers of this, the strange true story. The remains of our trees.
Now, much American poetry is clearly autobiographical. And your work, the first book, Strange Wood, seems more overtly autobiographical. And as we go through the three volumes, it becomes less seemingly overtly autobiographical. I wonder if you would say something about the role of fact and fiction, imagination and reality in your poetry.
Well, I think what happened was, you're right, it's exactly right, and what poem I just read for my second book is about as autobiographical as I've been since Strange Wood. I think what happened was, after I wrote Strange Wood, there's a sort of a true cliche that says everybody's first book is autobiographical, and it's true for me. I suddenly had this realization that it was a sort of a dual realization. One was that nobody really ought to care about me, that was sort of narcissistic, and secondly, that if I could stop writing about myself, I would have this entire world of things I could write about. So I made a very self-conscious decision just about the time that I wrote that poem that I would never write about myself overtly again and that I would try to write about bigger things.
Well, if that poem is autobiographical, it's an even more terrifying poem than it is anyway. If you've just tuned in, by the way, you're listening to Prosody, WIEP 91.3. I'm Michael Werster, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet Kevin Prufer, who's reading from his works, most recently Fallen from a Chariot, but he has a new book coming out soon from Four Way Books, and he's working on a fifth manuscript. So let's hear some more.
Okay. I'll read some new stuff, some of the stuff that's coming out from in my next book, National Anthem. This is called Army Tales. It's based on those pulp magazines called Army Tales. The boy who drowned in the bog. The boy caught in the rotors. The boy who laughed too loud. The boy who swallowed the bee that stung the throat. The ripcord worked, but the parachute fluttered weakly above and would not bloom. He put his foot down in the foreign grass and heard a click as of metal on metal when he lifted that foot. Sometimes it is a cold day and the clouds rain toxin over the boys on the base. Sometimes they don't know they're being watched, leaning against their packs asleep like that. One more, he said. One more, all around, and the assembled clapped for him. They clapped. He put his money down and smiled because they loved him. Sometimes a boy thinks he is unloved, so he retires to a dark tent where he will not be disturbed. Then his cells wink out like lights on a tall office building in a strange city at dusk. His friends said it was a sad day. It was very sad. They thought he'd been kidding. They told him not to laugh like that. You pull the string, and out it blooms. And what was he doing off the base late at night? What was he doing on the open water in the plane, driving so fast down unfamiliar roads? His mother, someone would tell her. Someone would write her a letter. Thank God there's a template for that. A guy who puts your name on the hard drive, a distant office, a simple program, and a printer. You punch in the name and out it comes.
Another.
Okay. I can read this poem called National Anthem.
Great.
It takes place at an outlet mall outside where I live in Warrensburg, Missouri, in a little farming town. National Anthem. And the shopping center said, give me, give me. And the moon, turning on its pole, said, I love you, you who have so much to give. And you said, darling, if you could just wait in the car for 10 minutes and I'll be right out. And the sliding doors opened for you like a coat. Then the car ticking like the contented in the catatonic snow and the black boys at the bus stop laughing in their hoods until a bus dragged them through the night and away. And a woman paced beneath the store. Sometimes I can hear the nation speak through the accumulation of the suburbs, Olive Garden and Exxon, Bed Bath and Beyond. The stars that throw their dimes around us all until the eyes say love and the streets say yes and the parking lot fills with angels blowing past the lines of freezing cars. You had been inside for longer than you said, and when you reemerged, I went to help you with the bags. I'm sorry, sorry, into the cold air. I couldn't help. What was the body but a vessel? And what was the store but another, larger vessel? The keys sang in my numb fingers. The flag applauded in the wind. And then I saw that you were smiling up at it.
Wow. Now, I had the privilege of hearing you read before an audience recently. And one of the things that I find very interesting, your poems, I read them prior, and your poems are frequently filled with pain, mutilation, and death. But when you do a reading, you're just so excited. You're having such a great time. And I would imagine that many people in the audience have no idea how dark those poems really are when they hear you read them, because it seems like so much fun.
Yeah, they're dark when I write them.
Yeah.
And maybe every poet loves having an audience so much that I can't help but smile and read them. I hope that doesn't come off as too sinister.
You really enjoy reading your poems, and a lot of poets, it seems like it's almost a duty. And it's great to see someone having so much fun reading their own work. I think it's terrific.
I think, you know, I always think about how they sound when I write them and read them out loud to myself as I write and think about, I don't know. Yeah.
Let's hear some more.
Maybe I'll read a couple from this poem, book I'm working on.
Great.
This is called The Villain and His Helicopter, Possible Movie Rental Versions. I've never read this out loud in my life, so this is a first. It's about all those different versions of videotapes you can get down at Blockbuster, not to give them a commercial on the air. In the simple VHS version, the blasted helicopter falls into the sea and disappears just before the credits scroll the picture away. On DVD, a commotion in the pod is visible. the rotors skirling up smoke, the helicopter tilting dangerously into the sea. In the digital letterbox limited edition, the villain presses his white face to the glass and groans, the helicopter's rotors grinding and coughing smoke. In the director's cut, you can hear the sound his fingers make against the glass, like little suction cups. In deluxe Dolby stereo, the engine dies in slow motion, every gear grinding perfectly away. The villain mouthing these words, "Tell my wife, my son." In the premiere unrated DVD, you can just discern the flashback to the villain's past, his mother singing him to sleep. In the widescreen Criterion edition, a single tear streaks his flushed cheek as the helicopter smiles like any good machine into the senseless reflecting sea.
Great. Your appearance here in Pittsburgh is part of a tour that you've been doing with two other poets, also from Missouri. Can you tell us something about your tour?
Well, it's just we're just driving around and doing readings here and there. It's with John Gallagher, a great poet and author of The Little Book of Guesses, and Wayne Miller, who's my co-editor and also a poet I admire a lot, and his book is Only the Senses Sleep. And we're reading in the Midwest. We're going to get back to Missouri, take a little break, and then we'll be reading in the West, in Colorado mostly.
It's an interesting coincidence that each of the three poets lives and teaches in Missouri, but they're all from Ohio.
Right.
That's an interesting coincidence.
Little joke we have that everybody's actually secretly born in Ohio.
There you go. Let's hear another poem.
Yeah, this is called Seeds, it's also a new one. The pepper on the cutting board and the seeds inside it, a tiny congregation in a doomed church. Or the sliced cantaloupe and its stringy heart, sweet and slick, the closest thing to rot. I was thinking of you. When distracted, I cut my hand so blood purled, then seed-like dripped into the sink. I was thinking of the thick blue vein where the IV goes, or the mourner who planted his wife beneath his window. She didn't sprout. Then one day an onion shoot which he devoured. Darling, do not die tonight. The doctors are good. The hospital quiet as a pill beneath chafe-like stars. Darling, I brought you flowers and sat by your bed until the white moon rolled behind the towers. These days the faucets won't stop dripping, and I stand in the kitchen dreaming of nurses who roam the white halls like quiet animals, and you in your bed unable to call them.
Do you think some people just have more imagination than other people? No? Okay.
No.
Let's hear another. You're listening to the poetry of Kevin Prufer.
Okay. I can read this poem called A Car Has Fallen from a Bridge. There is the death of the car, which was quiet and signifies little, ticking gently in a field of snow. And there is the death of the body, which was quick, the body unaware and cooling against the dash. Of course there is snow which wants so badly just to sleep, surrounding the car and the body where they came to rest. How gentle the snow seems from the car, like a gauzy curtain the wind blew from a window on a fall day perhaps years ago. How sweet the little paw prints where the sprung glass scattered. People drive over the bridge, not noticing the rail has torn away. Not noticing the car that rolled into the field and moments ago just died. I want to be younger than I am. I want to say to my mother, no, to cry in the back seat because I am bored and hungry and we are still 100 miles from home. The car lay in the field and the head slept on the dash. An ambulance pulled to the edge of the bridge but could not figure out how to descend to the frozen field and the car which was already dead. Sometimes I think I understand death, but my mother, whose heart just stopped while she spoke to a friend on the phone, painless, painless, I say then, and merciful, the receiver dangling from its cord, how nice to go that way, like a car that one moment is happy and another suspended in flight where the bridge broke loose. To the body, the snow is neither cold nor gentle. To the body, there's a zero where a field should be. If I only had a cell phone, I would try to call her.
That poem is from Fallen from a Chariot. We're in Pittsburgh, where one of our heroes is Andy Warhol, who spent a lot of time being obsessed with car wrecks and doing artworks of car wrecks. And I'm tempted to send a copy of that book to the Andy Warhol Museum with a note. Andy is reading in heaven. This is his favorite book of poems. Let's hear some more.
Okay. I feel like I should read some more car wreck poems. But I have so many car wreck poems. I had a series of them. I had to cut most of them because they were getting repetitive. But maybe I'll read this poem because it's composed entirely of questions. It's called Questions for the Drowned at Sea. Are you loose and vague as a sea grown still after rain? Or cool as salt water when the seasons fall, when the sun is low and the air is chill? Can you move? Do you say, I try, but my legs won't kick. I had my looks, but they've gone away. Can you swim? Are you closer now to a fish? Your mind all dumb and your head just float? Or to raft in the water's clasp, in the random swish and turn? How odd in the wide expanse, where the water yawns at the shore. What god swam off with your ghost? Did he stuff it in a bottle and give it to the winds and the sea, so its ink's gone smeared and the message is a muddle of blue? Will it roll in the surf or dry on the sands of the beach? Are you vessel or soul?
Wonderful. Let's hear another one of the new poems.
Okay. I could read this poem when I was a kid. I saw one of those made-for-TV movies about the Tsar and his family. Uh-huh. And the final scene of the movie, which scared me, was a scene of them lining up the family of the Tsar. I'm not even sure if this is apocryphal or not, as if to have their pictures taken. And they all thought they were being photographed. And then there were guns hidden in the camera. And, I have no idea what this movie is. Maybe somebody could tell me someday. This is called The Excavation of the Children of the Tsar. We thought the shovels were a war above our heads. Then voices and a spade in my pockmarked shoulder bone, where a bullet lodged and pained the joints. Poor Anna said they've come to put us on display again. And I laughed and said it was a garden party. And then a shaft of light to fill the skull holes up. They picked me up. My neck went slack. Someone said they'd take us to the lab and test what skin and hair remained. And someone said a bullet. And another, and Anna, who was wisest, they'll prop us in a golden case. They'll drape a flag across our bones. I've been a baby in a well. The air was damp. I cried and cried. I've been a secret in another's brain, and then the brain went cold, so no one knew. And now the jawbone aches to speak or sing. Alexei, stop. The wind devoured the sails, and Anna leaned against the boardwalk's rail, holding her hat to her head so the ribbons laughed in the storm. A man tied up his sailboat for the night. I climbed upon the rail to see. Alexei, she said, get down. I smiled and made a face. Get down, she said. You'll fall and hurt yourself. I didn't care. They packed us in a box and stowed us in a truck and carried us away. And then I fell, and falling cut my arm, so Anna pulled me to her breast, squeezed my arm to stop the blood, which never worked. She took a ribbon from her hat and made a knot above the cut. We hurried home through rain and up the palace steps where they put me in a room to heal, where Anna scolded me. The sun bled through a crack in the back of the truck. And Ella said, you shouldn't play so rough. I'll tell our father. She wiped a lock of hair from her wet forehead, then kissed my nose. She blew the candle out and closed the door. When we arrived, a man unpacked our bones and spread them on a table. The jawbone ached to speak, and the skull remembered. They posed us in a room as if to take our picture. Then the sound of gunfire from the camera.
you do a great job with people. And not just the people who are active, but even people who are just referred to. And they do a lot of things in that poem.
Thanks. I used to write stories. That was I secretly write whodunit mysteries under a...
Oh, that's great. Well, let me know when those start coming out.
They are. This is called Dead Soldier. It's funny. I couldn't help in this book called National Anthem, which everybody thinks is an ironic book, and I kind of don't feel that way. But I couldn't help writing about our present situation. This is called Dead Soldier. Where the living are, no one's missed him yet. The best of them will sing themselves to sleep. The others laugh too loud and swallow pills until their wet cells burst beneath the skin like grapes or bloom like urchins in a lukewarm sea. High above, the green moon glows in a windy sky like a half-dead cat and its one good eye. And who will coin his eyes and who would care? He who failed in school has failed again, and he who slept last night in a narrow bed will sleep in tents of sand with the collapsing dead.
I think we have time for one more.
Okay. This poem is composed entirely from lines taken out of Nancy Drew and The Secret of the Wooden Lady, which I was reading one day in the Hollins University Library in Southern Virginia, where I was working as at the checkout desk at the library on a very lonely day, and some student had just returned this book. So I wrote down all my favorite lines on note cards and then rearranged the note cards and then typed them up. So I didn't write this poem. Carolyn Keene wrote this poem. I arranged it. Nancy Drew and the Secret. Mystery or no mystery, the woman said. The family must eat. Nancy, her blonde hair still damp from the swim, skipped lightly up the carpeted stairway and tiptoed into her father's den. Tall, handsome Carson Drew thrust his hands into his pockets. Nancy thought she saw something moving. Come on, Dad, she said. Let me in on the mystery. All the windows were dark. Nancy thought she saw something moving in the rhododendrons next to the porch steps. That was odd, she thought. Hello, Nancy cried. Hello? She was halfway up the walk. Someone whirled her around and forced her toward the convertible. The arm was tight against Nancy's throat, a man's arm in a rough coat sleeve. His thumb pressed unbearably. Somehow she must give an alarm. She tried to scream, but her voice was weak and small. His thumb pressed unbearably. The horn. She leaned on it with all her weight. Presently, Mr. Beeman's front door flew open. A voice bellowed, Say, you look pretty shaky, Nancy. Sure you're all right? Nancy thought she saw something moving. Mystery or no mystery, the woman said. The family must eat. Come on, Dad, she said. Let me in on the mystery.
Kevin, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
The poetry of Kevin Prufer. Thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to Prosody, WYAP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the entertainment arts newsweekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineer is James Acklin. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock for Prosody, Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.